by 12. Using Big Roy's directions like they were a pirate's map, I turned right at the pecan tree and I found Olive's resting place, exactly where he promised it would be. The dusky gray of her tombstone dropped me to my knees. I landed hard on the packed, dark earth where grass grew only in determined little patches. Across the top of the stone was etched our family name. Underneath was Olive Ann, and to the right of that, Roy. I lost my breath, thinking a grave had already been laid for me, but then I realized that this resting place beside my mother was my father's. I know Big Roy, and I imagine he figured that he may as well get his name on there since he already hired the stonecutter. When it came time to bury him, I wouldn't be charged for anything but the date. I ran my hands over both their names, and I wondered where I would be planted when the time came. It was crowded in the cemetery. Olive had neighbors on all sides. On my knees, I stuffed the flowers into the tarnished metal vase affixed to the stone, but I didn't stand. "Pray," Big Roy had said. "Tell her what you need her to hear." I didn't even know where to start. "Mama," I said, and then the crying came. I had not cried since I was sentenced, and I had humiliated myself before a judge who didn't care. On that horrible day, my snotty sobbing had merged with Celestial and Olive's mournful accompaniment. Now I suffered a cappella. The weeping burned my throat like when you vomit up strong liquor. That one word, "Mama," was my only prayer as I thrashed on the ground like I was feeling the Holy Ghost, only what I was going through wasn't rapture. I spasmed on that cold black earth in pain, physical pain. My joints hurt. I experienced what felt like a baton against the back of my head. It was like I relived every injury of my entire life. The pain went on until it didn't, and I sat up, dirty and spent. "Thank you," I whispered to the air and to Olive. "Thank you for making it stop, and for being my mother, and for taking such loving care of me." And then I was still, hoping to maybe hear something in return, a message and a bird song, anything. But it was quiet. I gathered myself and stood up, dusting the dirt off my khakis the best I could. I laid my hand on the tombstone. "Bye," I mumbled, because I couldn't think of anything else to say. I was at the BP station, filling up my daddy's Chrysler with gas, when I finally heard what I think was my mama's voice in my ear. "Any fool can up and go." Whenever she started saying what any fool could do, she followed up with how a real man would handle the problem. Another favorite of hers was talking about what dogs were capable of, as in, "Even a dog can make a bunch of puppies, but a real man raises his kids." She made dozens of those observations. She aimed them at me constantly, and I did my best to be the real man she had in mind. But she never told me anything about saying goodbye, because as far as she was concerned, real men didn't have any need for farewells, because real men stay. With the gas nozzle in my hand, I paused to hear if she had any more wisdom to share, but apparently that was all I was going to get. "Yes, ma'am," I said aloud, and turned the Chrysler in the direction of the hardwood. I owed Davina Hardrick a real goodbye and some kind of thanks, too. Maybe I should give it to her straight and point out that she would be smart to rid herself of me, damaged goods that I was. I wasn't what they call relationship material. All that was the truth, and I wouldn't even have to mention Celestial. But even as I was going over this in my head, I knew it wasn't going to be as easy as that. What transpired between Davina and me was sexual, but it was more than that. It wasn't on the level of me and Celestial when we were trying to have a baby. It was kind of like dancing late at night when you're so drunk that the beat is in charge, so you look the woman in the eyes and you both move to the music the same way. That was part of how it was. And the other part was that she fucked me back to health. I would never actually say that. Some words women don't care to hear. But that's what happened. Sometimes the only thing that can cure a man is the inside of a woman. The right woman who does things the right way. This is what I should thank her for. When I arrived at her place, I rang the doorbell and waited, but I knew she wasn't there. I contemplated dropping a note, kind of like the one I left for Walter, but that didn't feel right. A dear John was bad, and a dear Jane was worse. This wasn't about me trying not to be cliche. It was about me trying to remember how to be a human being. How you would go about paying somebody back for reminding me what it felt like to be a man and not a nigger just out of the joint. What kind of currency would make us even? I didn't have anything to give but my sorry self. My sorry married self, to be a little more exact. I went back to the car, turned over the ignition, and flipped on the heat. I couldn't sit there until she got back, wasting time I couldn't afford to lose and burning gas I couldn't afford to waste. I rummaged through the glove compartment and found a golf pencil and a small pad. I should at least use a full-size sheet of paper if I was going to leave a note. I got out of the car and searched the trunk, but there was nothing in it but my duffel bag and an atlas. I sat on the fender, using the palm of my hand as a desk as I tried to think about what to write. Dear Davina, thank you very much for 2 days of restorative sex. I feel much better now. I knew better than to even press pencil to paper with that idea.
She at work,
said a voice behind me. There stood a little knucklehead about 5 or 6 years old, a felt Santa hat crooked on his peanut head. You talking about Davina? He nodded and forced a candy cane into a sour pickle wrapped in cellophane. You know what time she's coming back? He nodded and sucked on the pickle and peppermint. Can you tell me what time that is? He shook his head no. Why?
Because it might not be your business.
Justin,
said a woman from the porch next door where the French teacher once lived.
I wasn't talking to him,
Justin said.
He was the one talking to me.
To the woman on Mr. Fontenot's porch, I explained. I'm trying to find Davina. Justin said she's at work and I was wondering what time she would be home. The woman, whom I took to be Justin's grandmother, was tall and dark-skinned. Her hair, white at the temples, was braided across the top of her head like a basket.
How do I know it's your business?
Justin smirked at me. She's my friend, I said. I'm leaving town and I wanted to say goodbye.
You can leave her a note, she said. I'll give it to her.
She deserves more than a note, I said. The grandmother raised her eyebrows like she figured out what I was talking about. Not a see you later, but a true farewell.
It's Christmas time. She won't get off until midnight.
I couldn't spend the whole day waiting for the opportunity to disappoint Davina in person. It was 4:25 p.m., and I needed to get on the road. I thanked the grandmother and Justin before getting back in the car and headed toward Walmart. I walked through the store, scanning all the aisles until I found Davina in the back, near the craft supplies, cutting off a length of something blue and fuzzy for a thin man wearing glasses.
Give me another yard, he said,
and she flipped the bolt a couple of times and whacked at it with a pair of large scissors. She noticed me as she was folding the fabric and attaching the price tag. Handing it to the man, she smiled at me, and I felt like the worst person in the world. When the man walked away, I advanced to the table like I, too, needed something measured and cut.
Can I help you, sir?
She said, smiling like this was some kind of holiday game. Hey, Davina, I said. Can I talk to you for a minute?
You okay?
She asked, eyeing my dirty clothes.
Did something happen?
No, I said. I just didn't get a chance to change, but I need to talk to you right quick.
I don't have a break coming up, but grab some fabric and come back. I can talk to you here.
The fabrics, arranged by color, reminded me of Saturdays with my mother, the way she would drag me to Cloth World in Alexandria. Grabbing a bolt of red fabric flecked with gold, I returned to the cutting table and handed it to Davina, who immediately started pulling the cloth free.
Sometimes people ask how much we have, so we have to measure it all. So I'll do that while you talk. What's up? You here to say you miss me?
She smiled again. I'm here to say that I'm going to miss you, I said.
Where are you going?
Back to Atlanta.
For how long?
I don't know.
You going back to her?
I nodded.
That was your plan the whole time, wasn't it?
She snatched hard at the cloth until the spool was bare and the fabric was stretched out on the table, looking like a movie star red carpet. She measured it against the yardstick at the edge of the table, counting under her breath. I don't mean it like that, I said.
I distinctly asked you if you were married.
And I told you I didn't know.
You didn't act like you didn't know?
I want to say thank you. That's why I'm here, to say thank you and goodbye. Davina said,
I want to say fuck you. How about that?
What we did was special, I said, feeling like a jackass, although I had not uttered a single lie. I care about you. Don't be like this.
I can be however I want.
She was mad, but I could see that she was trying not to cry.
Go on then, Roy. Go on back to Miss Atlanta. But I want two things from you.
Okay, I said, eager to do something and show her that I was cooperating, that I didn't want to hurt her.
Don't scandalize my name by talking about how when you got out of jail, you were so desperate that you knocked off some girl from Walmart. Don't say that to your friends.
I wouldn't say that. It wasn't like that. She held up her hand.
I mean it. Don't taste my name in your mouth. And Roy Hamilton, promise me you will not ever come banging on my door.
Celestial. Is it love or is it convenience? Gloria asked me that Thanksgiving day after my father had stormed upstairs and Andre went to gather our coats. She explained that convenience, habit, comfort, obligation, these are all things that wear the same clothing as love sometimes. Did I think this thing with Andre was maybe too easy? He is literally the boy next door. If my mother were here now, she would see that what we had chosen was anything but convenient. It was Christmas time, and I own a business with a staff of two, and now my wrongfully incarcerated husband is released, and I have to tell him that I'm engaged to another man. The situation was a lot of things. Tragic, absurd, unlikely, and maybe even unethical, but it was not convenient. As Andre ran his lines, rehearsing the speech that we agreed would explain ourselves to Roy as gently as possible, I looked up into the empty branches and wondered aloud how long Old Hickey had been here. Our houses were constructed in 1967. As soon as the last brick was mortared into place, our parents moved in and commenced making babies. But Old Hickey predated all of that. When workers cleared the land to build, scores of pine trees were cut down and the stumps blasted from the ground. Only Old Hickey had been spared. Andre slapped his hand against the rough bark. Only way to tell is to cut it down and count the rings. I don't want to know that bad. The answer is old. Hickey has seen it all. You ready? I asked him. There's no ready, Dre said, leaning back on the tree and pulling me close. I didn't resist and pushed my fingers through his dense hair. I leaned to kiss his neck, but he gripped my shoulders and held me away so we could see each other's faces. His eyes reflected back the grays and browns of winter. You're scared, he said. I can feel shaking beneath your skin. Talk to me, Celestial. It's real, I said. What we have is real. It's not just convenience. Baby, Dre said, love is supposed to be convenient. It's supposed to be easy. Don't they say that in 1 Corinthians? He held me close against him again. It's real. It's convenient. It's perfect. Do you think Roy will come back with you? He might. He might not, Andre said. What would you do if you were him? Andre let me go and stepped over the raised roots of the tree. The air was chilly but clean. I can't say, because I can't imagine being him. I've tried, but I can't even walk around the corner in his shoes, let alone a mile. Sometimes I think that if I were him, I would be a gentleman, wishing you well and letting you go with dignity. I shook my head. Roy wasn't that type of man, although he had dignity in spades. But for a person like Roy, letting go wasn't a self-respecting option. Gloria once told me that your best quality is also your worst. For herself, she identified her ability to adapt. I've likely rolled with punches when I should have hit back, she said. But I rolled my way into a life I love. She told me that since I was very small, I have embraced my appetites. You always run toward what you want. Your father always tries to break you of this, but you are just like him, brilliant but impulsive and a tiny bit selfish. But more women should be selfish, she said, or else the world will trample you. Roy, in my mind, was a fighter, a characteristic whose double edges were gleaming and sharp. But I don't really know, Andre said, thinking aloud. He feels like everything was taken from him, his job, his house, his wife, and he wants all his shit back. He can't get his job back. Corporate America waits for no man, let alone a black man. But he's going to want his marriage back, like you have been in cold storage all these years. So now it's my job to snatch the fantasy away. He motioned to take in our houses, our bodies, maybe even our city. I feel guilty as hell. I can't lie. Me too, I said. For what? He asked, slipping his arms around my waist. Since I could remember, my father has told me how lucky I was, how I never had to struggle, how I eat every day, how nobody has ever called me nigger to my face. He used to say, accident of birth is the number one predictor of happiness. Once Daddy took me to the emergency room at Grady, so I could see how poor black folks are treated when they got sick. Gloria was mad when I came home, 8 years old, shook to the bone. But he said, I don't mind living in Cascade Heights, but she needs to know the whole picture. Gloria was furious. She is not a sociological test case. She is our daughter. Daddy said, our daughter needs to know things. She needs to know how fortunate she is. When I was her age, my mother cut him off. Stop it, Franklin. This is how progress works. You have it better than your daddy, and I have it better than mine. Don't treat her like she stole something. To which my daddy said, I'm not saying that she stole it. I just want her to know what she has. Dre shook his head as though my memories were his own. You deserve your life. There are no accidents of birth or anything else. Then I kissed him hard and sent him on his way to Louisiana, like I was sending him off to war.
Roy. P.O. Box 973, Elo, Louisiana, 98562. Dear Walter, hello from the other side. Ignore the return address on this letter because I don't know where I'll be by the time you get this. Right now, I'm in a rest stop outside of Gulfport, Mississippi, where I'm going to get a room for tonight. Tomorrow morning, I'll head to Atlanta to find Celestial and see if I have any life left there. It could go either way. I don't think I make it too much of the fact that she didn't divorce me, and this time tomorrow, I will know. I have money in my pocket, and I'm grateful for that. When I was a boy, I had a little savings account. I went to the branch this past Tuesday to clean it out, and there I experienced a minor miracle. Olive stopped adding to my commissary after it was clear the Celestial was handling that, so she started saving for my future. The money she made from selling cakes on Saturdays, she put away for me, so I have nearly $3,500. This means I don't have to show up on Celestial's doorstep like a homeless person, but that's what I am, I guess. But at least I don't have to be a broke homeless person. Celestial doesn't know that I'm coming, and I'm glad that I don't have to hear your wisdom on that. It's complicated, but she sent Andre to Elo to come and collect me. By my calculations, he should be hitting the highway first thing tomorrow morning. This is why I didn't tell her I was coming. I need to see her by herself, not with Dre hanging around. I'm not saying that there's anything between them, but I'm saying that there has always been something between them. You know what I mean? Or am I the one being a junior Yoda? But the point is that I need to talk to her without anyone blocking. So if he drives way out to Louisiana, it will take him another day to get back. So that gives me 2 days to get done what I need to do. Admit it, it's a smart plan. Maybe I am your kid after all. Anyway, I'm going to put some of this money on your books. Don't spend it all in one place. And take care of yourself. And if you can, pray for your boy. Roy O. 3. Generosity.
Andre. We were not abandoning him. We were not telling him that he was unwelcome. I was to go to Elo, and we were going to sit down, alone, and talk. I would explain that Celestial and I had been seeing each other for the last 2 years, that we were engaged. But this didn't mean he didn't have a home to go to. If he wanted to settle in Atlanta, we would set him up with an apartment, whatever he needed to get on his feet. I was to stress how glad we were that he was out, and how grateful we are to finally see justice done. Celestial suggested the word forgive, but I couldn't give her that. I could ask for understanding. I could ask for temperance, but I wouldn't ask him to forgive me. Celestial and I were not wrong. It was a complex situation, but we were not on our knees before him. Right before we drifted off to sleep, Celestial murmured, "Maybe I need to go. Be the one to tell him." "You got to let me do this," I said. It wasn't much of a plan, but it was all I had. That and a styrofoam cup leaching chemicals into my truck stop coffee. Once I exited the interstate, I handled my vehicle like I was taking my driver's exam. The last thing I needed was to attract police attention, especially on the back roads of Louisiana. If it could happen to Roy, it could happen to me. Besides my conspicuous skin, my car was a stunner. I'm a humble man about most things. I care nothing for kicks, and Celestial sometimes throws away my favorite old shirts when I'm not looking. But I do like myself a fine vehicle. The truck, Mercedes M-Class, had gotten me pulled over a half dozen times in the last 3 years, and once I was even slammed against the hood. Apparently, make plus model plus race equal drug dealer, even in Atlanta. But this was mostly when I drove through neighborhoods that were all-out hood, or hood-ish, although Tony's suburbs like Buckhead weren't safe either. You know what they say, if you go 5 miles outside of Atlanta proper, you end up in Georgia. You know what else they say? What do you call a black man with a PhD? The same thing you call one driving a high-end SUV. I almost didn't recognize Roy's house without the Chrysler parked in the yard. I circled the block twice, confused. The Huey Newton chairs on the porch convinced me that I was in the right place. As I pulled in close to the house, my bumper kissing the porch, a bank of floodlights hit me, and I shielded my eyes like I was staring into the sun. "Hello," I called. "It's me, Andre Tucker. I'm here for Roy Jr." The neighbors played music, Zydeco, loud and jaunty. I walked slowly, like I was worried that someone might want to shoot me if I made any sudden moves. Roy Sr. stood behind a screen door, wearing a striped butcher's apron.
"Come on in, Andre," he said. "You eat yet? I'm fixing to make some salmon croquettes."
I shook his hand and he led me to the built-on living room I remembered from the last time I was here. The hospital bed was gone, and the green recliner looked new. "I'm here to pick up Roy, you know." Big Roy walked toward the center of the house with me close behind. In the kitchen, he readjusted his apron strings, knotting them around his barrel torso.
"Little Roy is gone."
"Gone where?"
"Atlanta."
I sat down at the kitchen table. "What?"
"You hungry?"
Big Roy asked.
"I can fix you some salmon croquettes."
"He's gone to Atlanta. When did he leave?"
"A while ago. Let me get you something to eat, then we can talk about the details."
He handed me a glass of purple Kool-Aid, which tasted like summertime. "Thank you, sir. I appreciate your hospitality, but can you give me the broad outline? Roy is gone to Atlanta. How? Plane? Train? Automobile?" He pondered this like a multiple-choice test as he cranked the lid off of a can. Finally, he said,
"Automobile."
"Whose car?"
"Mine."
I pressed the heels of my hands to my eyes. "You've got to be kidding me."
"Nope."
I took my phone out of my pocket. We were probably 100 miles from the nearest cell tower, but I had to try.
"Cell phones don't work so well out here. All the kids want them for Christmas, but it's a waste of money."
I checked the screen. My battery was good to go, but there were no signal bars. I couldn't shake the feeling that I was being set up. On the wall was mounted a green phone, rotary model. I nodded toward it. "May I?" Crumbling Ritz crackers, he slumped his shoulders and said,
"They cut it off yesterday. With Olive gone, it has been hard making ends meet."
I was quiet as he worked over the little bowl, cracking an egg and then stirring the mixture with slow, careful strokes.
like he was afraid to hurt it. "I'm sorry to hear this," I said, embarrassed for even asking about the phone. "I'm sorry to hear it has been so hard." He sighed again.
"I get by, mostly."
I sat down at the kitchen table and watched Big Roy cook. The years had clearly grabbed him by the throat. He was the same age as my own father, give or take, but his back was stooped and wrinkles pulled at the corners of his mouth. This is the face of a man who has loved too hard. I compared him with my own father, vain and handsome, complexion as smooth as glass. Carlos's signature gold chain was sort of Saturday Night Fever. At least that's how I always thought of it. But maybe he treasured it as his mother's gift of protection. I wasn't sure yet what it meant to me. Plunking the fish patties into a skillet of hot grease, Big Roy said,
"You're going to have to stay tonight. It gets dark so early in the winter. It's too late to get back on the road. Besides, you don't look like you got another 7 hours in you."
I crossed my arms on the table to make a nest for my heavy head. "What is going on?" I asked, not really expecting an answer. Finally, the simple meal was served, salmon croquettes and a side of sliced carrots. The croquettes were edible, if not good, but I didn't have much appetite. Big Roy ate his entire meal with a short fork, even the carrots. He smiled at me from time to time, but I didn't quite feel welcome. After dinner, I washed the dishes while he carefully poured the used cooking grease into a tin jar. We dried the dishes and put them away tag-team style, with me pausing every few minutes to see if a signal had somehow made it to my phone. "What time did Roy leave?" I asked.
"Last night."
"So," I said, doing the math.
"He made it to Atlanta right about the time you were leaving."
Once everything was clean, dried, put away, and wiped down, Big Roy asked me if I drank Johnny Walker. "Yes, sir," I said. "Might as well." At last, we settled ourselves in the den, glasses in hand. I sat on the firm sofa, and he chose the big leather recliner.
"When Ollie first died, I couldn't bring myself to lay in my own bed. For a month, I slept in this chair, leaned it back, and put the footrest up. Pillow, blanket. That's how I spent the whole night."
I nodded, picturing it, remembering him at the funeral, destroyed but determined. "Next to him," Celestial had said, "I felt like a fraud." I didn't tell her, but Big Roy provoked the opposite reaction in me. I felt his emotions, deeper than the grave, and I understood his hopelessness too, his longing for a woman you could never hold.
"It took me a year to learn how to sleep without Olive, if you call what I do at night sleeping."
I nodded again and drank. Photos of Roy of various ages watched me from the dark panel walls. "How is he?" I asked. "How is Roy making out?" Big Roy shrugged.
"As good as you could expect, having spent 5 years locked away for something he didn't do. He lost so much. And not only Olive. Before this, Roy was on the track, you know. He did everything he was supposed to do. Got way farther than me. And then..."
I flopped back in the seat. "Roy knew I was coming. Why did he take off on his own?" Big Roy took a judicious sip and bent his expression into something similar to a smile, but not quite.
"Let me start by saying that I appreciate you playing a role in my wife's home going. When you grabbed that other shovel, I know you were sincere. I appreciate you for that, too. I am honest right now in thanking you."
"You don't have to say thank you," I said. "I was just..." But then he cut me off.
"But son, I know what you're doing. I know what you came to tell little Roy. You got a thing going on with Celestial."
"Sir, I..."
"Don't try to deny it."
"I wasn't going to deny it. I was going to say that I didn't want to discuss it with you. It's between me and Roy."
"It's between her and Roy. They're the ones married."
"He has been gone 5 years," I said. "And we thought he had about 7 more to go."
"But he's out now," Big Roy said. "Those two are legally married. Young people don't respect the institution. But I tell you, back when I married Olive, marriage was so sacred that everyone aimed for a wife that was fresh, just out of her father's house. They tried to warn me away from her because she had a child.
but I didn't listen to nothing but my heart.
Sir, I said, I can't say what I think about the institution in general, but I know where things stand with me and Celestial.
But you don't know where things stand with Roy and her. That's the only thing I care about. I don't give a damn about you and your feelings. Only thing that matters to me is my boy.
Big Roy shifted forward. I thought he was going to hit me, but he reached for the remote and activated the television. On the screen, a chef was demonstrating some kind of miracle blender. I didn't say anything for maybe a minute until the phone rang, long and loud like a fire alarm.
I thought you said it was disconnected.
I lied, he said, raising his eyebrows.
I wouldn't have figured you for this, I said, betrayed. I was tired of being subjected to the whims of fathers, Roy's, Celestial's, and my own. I thought you were about honor. Your word is your bond, all of that.
You know,
this time he was smiling.
I felt bad about telling you that lie, until you believed it.
Now the smile bent into a smirk.
Tell me, do I look like someone who can't pay my bills?
He chuckled, low and slow, but built up momentum with every breath. I swiveled my head, looking around for hidden cameras. This day was unspooling like a romantic comedy, one in which I don't get the girl.
Come on, Big Roy said. Sometimes all you can do is laugh.
And I did. At first, I was driven by an urge to be polite, to humor an old man, but something in my chest lubricated. And I cackled like a crazy person, the way you let loose when you suspect that God isn't laughing with you, but laughing at you.
But let me tell you one thing more, he said,
cutting off his chuckle like water at a tap.
I'm happy to let you stay tonight, but I'm asking you not to use my phone. You have been alone with Celestial for what, 5 years? You had all that time to make a case for yourself. Give Roy this one night. I see that you feel the need to fight for her. But let it be a fair fight.
I want to check and make sure she's all right.
She's all right. You know Roy Jr. isn't going to harm her. Besides, she knows a number. If she had something to say, she would have called you.
But that could have been her calling a little while ago. The elder Roy picked up the remote again like a gavel. When he shut off the television, the room was so quiet that I could hear the crickets outside.
Listen, I'm doing for Roy what your own father would do for you.
Celestial. I used to see him sometimes, so I had become accustomed to the stuttered breath, the dancing hairs on my suddenly cold arms and neck. You can live with ghosts. Gloria says that her mother returned to her every Sunday morning for over a year. Gloria would be looking in the mirror, rouging her lips, and over her left shoulder was her mother, freshly buried, but alive again in the glass. Sometimes she hoisted me on her hip. Do you see your Nana? All I could see was my own reflection, ribboned and ready for Sunday school. It's okay, Gloria said. She can see you. My father thinks this is ridiculous. His denomination, he says, is empiricism. If you can't count it, measure it, or gauge it with science, it didn't happen. Gloria didn't mind that he didn't believe her because she enjoyed having her mirror mother all to herself. I never glimpsed Roy's face in a pan of water or scorched into a slice of toast. My husband's ghost showed itself in the guise of other men, almost always young, haircuts Easter sharp, year-round. They didn't always share his physical attributes. No, they were as diverse as humanity. But I recognized them by the ambition that clung to their skins like spicy cologne, the slight breeze of power that stirred the air, and finally, a mourning that left my mouth tasting of ash. On the eve of Christmas Eve, Andre was burning up the interstate heading west, then south, to do my duty. I should have known better than to send a man to do a woman's job. But he insisted, "Let me do this for you." And I was relieved. I don't know what has happened to me. I used to be brave. As we danced at my wedding reception, my father had said, Let the man be the man sometimes. Giddy with love and champagne, I laughed at him. What does that even mean? Let him stand up to pee? Daddy said, at some point, you will come to accept your limitations. Do you accept yours? I asked, with challenge in my voice. But of course, Ladybug, that's what marriage teaches you. And I laughed at that too, as he spun me dizzy. Not my marriage. It's going to be different. On the eve of Christmas Eve, I packed Andre's overnight bag with clean clothes, blister packs of remedies in case he was struck with a headache, insomnia, or flu. Early the next morning, I stood in the driveway as he rolled away, careful not to cut his wheels and hurt the lawn, December brown but alive underneath. My legs tensed like they wanted to chase him and bring him back to my warm kitchen, but my arm waved and my lips said goodbye. And then I went to work. Poupées occupied prime real estate, where Virginia Avenue crossed Highland. This neighborhood was a kind of candy land, populated by renovated manors, adorable bungalows, cute cafes, and pricey boutiques. The ice cream parlors served generous scoops, hand-dipped by college-bound teenagers who spoke through colorful orthodontia. The only inconvenience was parking, and that was just trouble enough to make you appreciate the rest. Southwest Atlanta was my home. No later accidents of geography could ever change that, but sometimes I could picture Andre and me living on the northeast side of town or even in Decatur. I didn't want a fresh start, but maybe a little breathing room would be nice. We'd have to leave Old Hickey behind, but antique magnolias thrived in the Highlands, a different energy, but we'd adjust. When I arrived at the store, my assistant was already there. As I booted up the computers, Tamar fitted little antlers and red noses on the poupées in the front window. I watched her steady concentration, her attention to detail, and I thought that maybe she was my better case scenario. Prettier and 10 years younger, she could play me in the movie of my life. Tamar created intricate miniature quilts for the poupées, and I told her to sign each one. They hardly sold because they were as expensive as the dolls, but I refused to let her lower the price. Know your worth, I told her. The mother of a son born the week before she finished her master's degree at Emory, Tamara was slightly to the left of respectability, exactly where she liked to be. This close to Christmas, the dolls remaining in the store were like the kids who didn't get picked for kickball. Some of them were flawed on purpose. I made the eyebrows too thick or gave the doll a long torso with short, stubby legs. Somewhere out there was a girl or boy who needed to treasure something not quite perfect. These dolls, as crooked as real children, lined the shelves like eager orphans. Only one beautiful poupée remained, adorably symmetrical, chubby-cheeked, and shiny-eyed. Tamar fitted him with wings and a halo and then suspended him from the ceiling using fishing line. Once the display was situated, Tamar said, "Ready to rumble?" I consulted my watch, a gift from Andre. Old-fashioned, I wound it every morning. As pretty as a baby, it was heavy and noisy, jerking slightly as the seconds ticked. I nodded and unlocked the glass door, and we were open for business. The store became busy, but sales were sluggish. Often someone held a doll and couldn't quite figure out what was so disquieting and returned it to the shelf and looked away. But as they say, I couldn't complain. By the 25th, they would all be cozy under somebody's tree. After lunch, Tamar was antsy, fluffing and patting the dolls like pillows. "What's wrong?" I asked at last. She used her hand to indicate her magnificent bosom. "I need to pump, seriously. In 5 more minutes, I'm gonna pop a button." "Where's the baby?" "He's with my mother." "I tell you, the thrill of grandbabies will make even the most refined mother forgive you for getting knocked up." She laughed, happy with the cards in her hand. "Okay," I said, "go home and feed him. I'll be okay here till close. but do me a favor and pick up some muslin and bring it by my place. We'll have a holiday toast. I wasn't even done talking, and she was already struggling to button her coat. Do not buy the baby a pair of $300 sneakers, I told her, handing over a holiday bonus. She laughed, all Christmas and light, and swore that she wouldn't. But I can't promise not to buy him a leather jacket. And then I watched my delighted could-have-been self walk out the door. A few hours later, I was almost ready to close when a good-looking man dressed in a tan wool coat walked into the shop, announced by a jingle of bells. He was 100% Atlanta, his shirt still immaculate at the end of the business day. He seemed tired, but upbeat. I need a gift from my daughter, he said. Her birthday is today. She's 7. I need to get her something nice, and I need it fast. He didn't wear a ring, so I figured him to be a weekend dad. I walked him around the shop, and his eyes bounced off all the remaining dolls, the cheerful ragamuffins. Are you from here? He asked suddenly. Are you a native? I pointed at my chest. Southwest Atlanta, born, bred, and buttered. Same here, Douglas High, he said. So these dolls, they look kind of afflicted. Remember when we used to say that? I can't put my finger on it, but all of them are kind of off. Are these the only ones you have? They are all one of a kind, I said, protective of my creations. There are going to be variations. He gave a little laugh. You can save that lie for the white people. But seriously. Then he turned to the ceiling like he was searching for words, and his eyes landed on the doll boy floating over our heads. What about the one up there, just like an angel? He said. Is it for sale? Before I could answer, a movement across the street caught my eye. There, across busy Virginia Avenue, stood a Roy ghost. I had learned to suppress the startle, but this one caught me unaware because he actually looked like Roy. Not Roy when he was young, not Roy in the future. This looked like Roy would have looked if he had never left Elo. The never-left Roy ghost crossed his arms over his chest like a sentry. I kept my eyes on him as long as I could, knowing that if I turned away, he would vanish. Do you have a ladder? Said the man. If it's for sale, I can pull it down. It's for sale, I said. Suddenly, he sprang up like a basketball player and brought the angel to the ground. I guess I still got it, he said. You rap, right? The doll favored Roy, like a lot of them do. There are some as well that look like me, that look like Andre, that look like Gloria and Daddy. As the tall man watched, I laid the doll in a box lined with soft tissue paper. I paused, but the impatient tapping of his keys on the counter spurred me to take a breath and fasten the lid in place. It came in stages, this panic that started at my center and fanned out to the rest of me. I had just cut a length of ribbon the color of clean river water when I couldn't stand it any longer. Using my fingernail to break the tape, I opened the box, snatching the angel boy from the paper and held his firm body to my chest. You okay? The tall man said. I'm not, I admitted. He looked at his watch. What the hell? He said with a sigh. I'm already late. What's going on? My ex says I suck at emotions. Mimicking her, he squeaked. I can't teach you how to feel feelings. So I want to warn you that I'm probably about to say the wrong thing, but my intentions are good. My husband is getting out of prison. He cocked his head. Is this good news or bad news? It's good, I said too quickly. It's good. You sound like you're on the fence, he said. But I feel you. It's always a positive development for one more brother to be free. He then quoted his favorite rapper. Open every cell in Attica, send them to Africa. You remember that? I nodded, holding on to the angel boy. Take somebody like me, he said. Aside from a couple of knucklehead cousins, I don't know nothing about that incarceration life, but I know about being married. Divorced people, we are the ones who know. Forget the happy ones. They have no clue. How long has he been gone? 5 years, I said. Shit. Okay, that's a long time. I went to Singapore for 6 months for work. I was trying to make a living. She acted like the mortgage was going to pay itself. When I got home, the marriage was shot. Only 6 months. He shook his head. I'm just saying, don't get your hopes up. Incarceration aside, time is the quintessential mother. Then he held his hands out. Can I get the doll? It's the only good one left. I ushered him out, wondering if he weren't a ghost too, the ghost of what could have happened but didn't. He was my last customer for the evening. Foot traffic out front was brisk, but no one else entered the shop or even paused at the fanciful front window. I left a message for Tamar, and then I closed the store early, cutting the lights as my watch jerked the minutes away. I glanced across the street as I lowered the grate. No one was there, besides the parking attendant, who pulled his hat down over his eyes.
Roy. When I was a kid, I collected keys. You'd be surprised at how many are lying around once you learn to notice them. I stored them in jelly jars on the top shelf of my closet. After a while, Olive and Big Roy started bringing me keys they found, too. Mostly my collection consisted of 10 suitcase keys and quick-cut keys that could be replaced for less than a dollar at the hardware store. Once, at a flea market, I bought a Ben Franklin key, long shafted with 2 or 3 teeth at the bottom. But I didn't discriminate, appreciating the idea of holding the means to open dozens of doors. I imagined myself to be in a movie or a comic book. In the fantasy, I would have to unlock a gate, and I would try every key in my possession, finding the right one just in the nick of time. I probably kept this up from when I was 8 until I was about 12, when I realized that it was stupid. When I went to prison, I envisioned those keys every day. When I rolled into Atlanta, I entered the city up I-75-85 to see the skyline before me like the promised land. I know it's not like seeing the Empire State Building in New York or the Sears Tower in Chicago. As far as I know, Atlanta doesn't have any famous buildings. You might even say that there are no skyscrapers. Sky reachers, maybe, not skyscrapers. Regardless, the city is as enchanting as my mother's face. I lifted my hands off the wheel, rolling under the I-20 bridge with my palms to the sky like a brave kid on a roller coaster. I wasn't from this city, like Celestial, but I was of it, and it was thrilling to be home. She told me that Poupée's was in Virginia Highland, exactly where I had suggested that she set up shop, back when we were only dreaming. It was the perfect location, in the city where black folks could reach it easily, but in a zip code that made white people feel at home. I paid $10 to park my car in a lot across the street from her plate glass window. She had done well for herself. I had to give her that. Her daddy's money may have made it attainable, but she put in the work. The dials in the window were of all shades. Another one of my ideas. Benetton it up, I told her. And they looked to be having themselves a merry little Christmas. I stared at the display for 15 minutes. Maybe more, maybe less. It's hard to mark time when your heart is a pinball in your chest. I thought I saw her standing on a ladder, attaching a winged doll to the ceiling, but that girl was too young. She looked like Celestial did when I first met her, when she wouldn't give me the time of day. I watched for a while longer while the lookalike folded the ladder and disappeared into the back. Then Celestial emerged from behind a hot pink curtain, like she was walking onto a stage. She had cut her hair, not like a trim or a slightly different style. This new Celestial had almost no hair at all, rocking a Caesar like mine. I stroked my own head, imagining the feel of hers. It didn't make her look mannish. Even from across the street, I could see her big silver earrings and red lipstick, but she did seem more firm. I gazed, hoping to catch her eye, but she didn't feel my stare. She walked around her store pointing at things and helping people choose gifts, smiling. I watched until I got cold. Then I went back to my car, stretched out on the back seat, and slept like I was dead. When I woke up, I saw her again. But her lookalike was gone. She was by herself until a tall brother walked in, looking like a cross between Vibe and GQ.
I watched Celestial chat with him, but then she pitched her gaze in my direction, and her smile slid away like it was greasy. I don't exactly believe in telepathy, but I know that I used to be able to talk to her without talking. So I asked her to come outside, to cross the street, to meet me on the sidewalk. I had her for a few seconds, but she pulled away. I waited, hoping that she would restore the connection, but she returned her attention to the task at hand, suddenly clutching the doll to her chest. The brother smiled, and even though I couldn't see, I knew he flashed a mouthful of flawless teeth. Without my permission, my tongue went to the blank place in my lower jaw. But also without my permission, my hand visited the key ring in the front pocket of my pants. The key ring was among the things I carried out of prison in a paper sack. The rubber-topped car key would fit the family-ready sedan. I didn't know if Celestial kept it, but wherever it was, this key would turn over the ignition. The thick, toothless key used to open my office door. But you could bet dollars to donuts that a locksmith remedied that faster than you could say guilty as charged. The last key, a copy of a copy of a copy, matched the front door of the pleasant house on Lynn Valley Road. I wondered about that key more than I should have. Once or twice, I opened my mouth and stroked the jagged edge against my tongue. On paper, it had never been my house. When Mr. D deeded this property over to Celestial, the only string attached was that old hickey couldn't be cut down. It was like the way movie stars die and leave their fortune to a French poodle. The tree was mentioned by name, but Roy Hamilton was nowhere on the thick stack of documents that sealed the deal. This home, she promised, was a wedding gift to us both. The key is in your pocket, she said. And the key was in my pocket now. But would it work? Celestial didn't file for divorce. After the first year of no visits, I asked Banks if she could end the marriage without informing me, and he said, technically, no. I know she dear John to me, but that was 2 years ago, when I was facing a lot more time. But 2 years gave her ample opportunity to divorce a brother if that's what she wanted to do, and plenty of time to hire a locksmith. With the keys in my pocket tinkling like sleigh bells, I returned to the Chrysler, cranked the engine, and headed west. Pressing the accelerator, I kept my mind on one thing, the worn brass key, as light as a dime and labeled home.
Celestial. I know this house as I know my own body. Before I opened the door, I felt the presence within the walls the way the tiniest cramp in your womb lets you know to get ready, even though it has only been 3 weeks since the last time. As I stepped into the vestibule, the skin on my arms puckered and pilled, sending rapid sparks crisscrossing along the pathways of my blood. Hello? I called, not knowing what to expect, but sure I was not alone. Who's there? I may see ghosts, but I don't believe in haints. A ghost is a memory made solid, while a haint is a human spirit got free from the body but traveling this earth just the same. Hello, I said again, not sure what I believed in now. I'm in the dining room, boomed a man's voice that was definitely of this world, familiar and foreign at the same time. There sat Roy at the head of the table, with his fingers laced and fitted into the cave between his chin and chest. My arms were full of silly groceries for my planned evening with Tamar. Lime sherbet, Prosecco, chocolate blended with cayenne pepper, and goldfish crackers for the baby. You didn't change the locks on me. Roy rose from his seat, his face glowing with wonder. After all of everything, you made sure my key would still work. He took the bags from my arms as though it were the most natural thing in the world, leaving me standing there with nothing. Dre is on his way to get you, I said, following Roy to the kitchen. He left today. I know, he said, the bag of food between us like a truce. It wasn't Dre I wanted to talk to. I rubbed my arms to quiet the tingling as he set the bag down on the counter and then spun toward me and spread his arms, grinning, showing the dark space in the bottom of his smile. You don't have love for a brother? I went through a lot of trouble to get here. Don't give me that Christian side hug. I want the real thing. I walked toward him on legs that didn't feel like my own. He closed his arms around me, and I knew that this was my husband, not some sleight of mind. This was Roy Othaniel Hamilton. He was bigger now than when he lived in this house, his body harder and more muscular, but I recognized his energy, almost on the verge of action. Unaware of his own strength, he grabbed me so hard that I felt a little dizzy. I'm home, Celestial. I'm home. He released me, and I filled myself up with greedy gulps of air. Roy's face was broader and more lined than when I last saw him 2 years ago. I let my hand go to my own face, smooth with makeup, and then I remembered my head, almost clean-shaven. I almost felt that I should apologize, remembering how he used to roll a single strand of my hair between his fingers. Sometimes he said out loud that Roy III should inherit his eyes, but my hair. He was prepared for this encounter. The starch scent of his new shirt mingled with the sweet fragrance of barbershop ointment. I was caught flat-footed, looking and feeling like the end of a long day. I didn't plan on waylaying you like this, he said. There should be a word, I thought, for this experience, when you're surprised, but at the same time the moment feels completely inevitable. Sometimes you read about these 60s radicals who accidentally killed a cop, or maybe they did it on purpose, I don't know. But they run away, get a new name, and lead a clean, boring existence. They put on weight, they shop at Macy's. But one day, they come home, and there is the FBI. Their faces, flat on newsprint, always look astonished, but not surprised. I missed you, Roy said. I have a lot of questions, but I need to say first that I miss you. I could recite Andre's speech like lines from a play, these words he and I determined had to be said. And wasn't Gloria right when she said that telling this particular truth was a woman's work? But I stood in the shade of my husband returned home, and I couldn't bring myself to speak a single necessary word. He led me to the living room, like this was still his house. He looked around. This room didn't used to be turquoise, did it? It was yellow, wasn't it? Goldenrod, I said. All this African stuff is new. I like it, though. Along the walls were masks, and on nearly every flat surface was a carving, all keepsakes from my parents' travels. He picked up a small ivory figurine depicting a woman ringing a bell. This is real, isn't it? Poor elephant. It's antique, I said, a little defensive, from before elephants were endangered. Not that this would make a difference to the elephant in question, he said, but I get your point. We sat down on the leather sofa and looked at each other. We let the silence grow thick, waiting for the other to break the peace. Finally, he scooted so close that our hips touched. Tell me, Celestial. Tell me whatever it is that you have to say. I shook my head no. He carried my unguarded fingers to his lips and kissed them twice. Then he rubbed my hands over his fresh-shaven face. Do you love me? Whatever else is details. I moved my lips as wordless as a goldfish. You do, he said. You didn't divorce me. You didn't change the locks. I had my doubts, you know I did, but when I was on the front porch, I decided to try my key. It slid in easy and turned slippery like WD-40. That's how I knew, Celestial. That's how I knew. I didn't walk all over your house. I waited in here because I know you don't use these rooms. Whatever it is, I want to hear it from you. When I didn't say anything, he said it for me. It's Andre, isn't it? It isn't yes or no, I said. Then he surprised me by laying his head in my lap, reaching